meaningful halacha. Came out of an issue of, when we practice mitzvot, when we, try to, include halachic consciousness in everything we do, do we have a sense that it really is deeply meaningful to us as Jews, to us as human beings, rather than merely, sort of touching bases and doing things in a rote and, disciplined but kind of mechanistic way? Do we really have a sense that what we're doing has deep meaning for us as Jews? And this is what we want to pursue. And I thought a valuable approach, this first approach, this issue of meaningful halakha, would be through the Rambam. And I think it's clear that that the Rambam is one of the most thoughtful of all our, all our great chachamim. He's known as not only the consummate posek, halachic decision maker, but also, he was a great philosopher, and his halachic mind and his philosophic mind were not separate. He combined them and he integrated them together in a profound way to give us a very deeply meaningful approach to the life of mitzvot, a deeply meaningful approach to mitzvot and to halacha in general. And this is what I'd like to pursue together. We'll take a look first at some, the first few shiurim in our series at the Mishneh Torah and his approach to halacha in his great halachic code, which I'll give some background to in a moment. And then we'll also include some material from his guide at the Perplexed, the Mor Nevuchim, his great philosophic work. I mean, the Rambam was extraordinary two of the greatest texts of Torah literature. He's the author, the Mishneh Torah, which is a vast halachic code, and the Guide of the Perplexed, which is a vast journey, spiritual journey. It's two amazing works, and we'll see what his view of halacha is in both of them together. All right, so our focus, let me just lay out two things before we start. One is, I have a technical challenge. Every once in a while, my computer freezes up. I hope it doesn't happen during this hour we have together. But if you see me sort of go like this, and I'm not moving, you know it has happened. If that happens, be patient for a moment. I'll have to sign off, re-sign on. It'll take probably 2 minutes to get back on Zoom and everything. But hopefully it just won't happen. Okay, Be'ezrat Hashem. In terms of the approach here, I guess I'll talk for a while and hopefully leave time for discussion at the end. I think that's the best way rather than interrupt. But if you have a absolutely burning question, particularly if you don't understand something I said, you just don't get it, you can raise your hand and I'll unmute yourself and we'll have a brief discussion on the text itself, and then continue and have a broader discussion at the end. Okay, so I'll try to leave time for that. Okay, so I'm going to take a moment now and share screen with everyone. Judy has sent this out, but I'll also show it here. Okay, can everyone see this text? Can you nod your head? Can you, first of all, can you see it at all? It's come up. Hopefully you can read it.
Can you make it bigger? Is that possible?
There's going to be a limit on that. Let's see what we can do.
That's better.
That's better? Okay. Hopefully that works. All right. The Mishneh Torah.
We could also expand it ourselves.
That's true. Fingers. Yes. So you can do that yourself.
Thank you very much, Sippy.
Thank you for that. The Mishneh Torah, the Rambam's great code of Jewish law. It's an extraordinary work. I'll just say briefly, he wrote it over the period of from 1170 to 1185, around 10 to 15 years. Okay, it's quite an accomplishment. It's vast. One of its most unique aspects is its scope. It includes all of Jewish law. All of halacha. This was unique. Codes before him only focused on mostly on what we call Orach Chaim, on ritual law, on law that was in practice at the time of exile, of Galut. You know, so it would be, it would, most of the codes of law prior to the Rambam did not have laws of sacrifices, did not have the agricultural laws, didn't have the laws of purity, you know, Tumah Tahara. They only focused on very practical issues in Galut. The Rambam had this vision to include all of Jewish law for all time, from the time of the temple up to the time of the Mashiach and everything in between. Now, this would seem like an intellectual exercise in the Middle Ages, but, you know, an academic exercise, but actually very, very practical. When we came back to Eretz Yisrael, I'm just to get the you know, the significance of this. And we came back to Eretz Yisrael, you know, in the, you know, the late 19th and then in the early 20th century in the Zionist movements, and we reestablished, you know, our presence here in Israel, and we established the state of Israel. And you know that at the beginning, it was agricultural, you know, the kibbutzim, the agricultural moshavim, that really, you know, founded and rooted our people in back in Eretz Yisrael, and still is very important today. Those, we had to go back and learn what are the halachot, the mitzvot and the halachot of agriculture. You know, we have halachot of what we can plant next to what we can't plant, and how to, take truma, maaser. There's halachot for everything. And the only text that started to, you know, that guided us at that time was the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Most other rabbis didn't bother with that. They didn't think it was practical. The Rambam knew that at some point in Jewish history, this would be practical again. And it is. And we're grateful for the Rambam that we open up, when we have issues of, you know, how to do Shemitah, how to do, how to avoid Kilayim, how to do all of these agricultural things. Those, you know, Karen, I see you there. You have a nice little, trees and plants out in, your garden. You look to the Rambam for this, you know, to know how to do, how to keep a garden, how to do this. So, the scope of the Mishneh Torah includes all of Jewish law for all time, up to and including the Mashiach, and we'll see some of that. Also, the codification. It's a new setup. The Rambam, you know, and a system of codifying Jewish law, not following the structure of the Mishnah, though it certainly includes the Mishnah, which was our first structure of Jewish law. But he said he came up with his own analysis of how all of Jewish law fits together, halacha, and he lays out his Mishneh Torah in that way. It's also a very clear text and written in elegant Hebrew, gorgeous Hebrew. So it's it's a vast and wonderful work. And very profound thinking goes into it. The Rambam begins, interestingly, this halachic code, with a philosophical tract. This is the laws of the foundation of the foundations of the Torah, Yisodei HaTorah, foundations of the Torah. The Rambam was committed to this, that a deep spiritual understanding, which is a sophisticated philosophical spiritual understanding, is an essential aspect of Torah. And it grounds our, whole approach to all of the rest of halakha. It gives us a meaningful and thoughtful and mature approach to halakha. You know, looking at halakha not as just a, you know, a set of rituals, but as a real and meaningful way of serving Hashem. So he begins with mitzvot that are the philosophical mitzvot, and lays out along with that, with, you know, sets them in a context that is profoundly philosophical. And let's take a look at what he does. So first of all, he gives us a list. In each of his books, he tells you what mitzvot will be in those books. And so to understand that this is a book, this is a code of mitzvot, even though now he's going to go into philosophy. So six positive and four prohibitive, you know, mitzvot, aseh, lo taseh, six positive, four prohibitive mitzvot, in this section, to know that there is God, not to think that there is another God other than God, to unify God, God is one, to love God, to fear God, to sanctify his name, not to desecrate his name, not to destroy things upon which his name is called, and to listen to a prophet, a Navi, who speaks in his name, and not to test God. Okay, so 10 mitzvot that are included in what will be a philosophical vision of halakha, as we'll see. So he begins. The foundation of foundations and the pillar of wisdoms. In the Hebrew, Yesod Yesodot, he gives us a yud, hey, vav, and hey beginning to this. It's in the Hebrew. So the foundation of foundations, the pillar of wisdoms, is to know that there is a first existent, that he brought to existence all existence, and that all existence from heaven and earth and what is between them would not exist except for the reality of his existence. Okay.
What's the Hebrew word used in existence?
Yeah, so this is matsui rishon. Sheyesham matsui rishon. It's an interesting term. He does not use the word havaya rishona, which we would translate as a first being. He uses a more specific term, matsui, it's that which we find to be. There's a reason why he's doing that, and we'll see why in just a moment. But you're absolutely right, it's an interesting question. But matsui rishon, it's l'matzah, to find. Also interesting in this formulation, what's the first mitzvah here? Notice the language. It says the pillar of foundation of pillar of wisdom is to know that there is a first existent. To know. The word that he doesn't use is to believe. In his commentary on the Mishnah, he uses the word la'amin, which is to have faith, to believe. He changes that here. He says, the mitzvah here is not to believe that there is God, but to know that there is God. And that's an extraordinary change. Most people would say, the first mitzvah of the Torah, and what's Anochi Hashem Elokecha, and the first of the Ten Commandments, is to believe that there's God. No, belief is not enough for the Rambam. What's belief? We have it saying, belief is to pretend that you know something when you don't really know it. That's belief, and it's not much of anything. It's just a fantasy, right? That's not enough for the Rambam. You got to know that there is a first existent. Now, each of us may be struggling with how we understand God, and even struggling with a sense of God. But the Rambam's point is not that we have to know God. We can't know God completely. It's not possible for a human being to know God in God's full reality, but to know that there is God and to be really sure about that and to be able to, not as a belief, but as a knowledge, and to be on the way towards assuring yourself, to having real knowledge of God, that's the mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah to believe, okay? This sets up a challenge. And I know many, many rabbis today speak of belief in God. We don't believe in God. That's pretending. We know God to the best that we can, and we're on the way towards that. And that's the way the Rambam defines this mitzvah. It's a challenge. Yeah. And that, now listen to the way he puts this out. To know that there's a first existent, okay, and this is, of course, an eternal existent that has always been, always will be, the first existent, that he brought to existence all existence. Existence is little us little existent things and all creatures. Nimtzaim is the term that he uses here in the Hebrew. So he's playing on matsui, nimtza, da da da. And that all existent beings from heaven and earth and what is between would not exist except for the reality of his existence. Amitat himatso, the reality of his existence. Interesting formulation. What he's not saying here is that there is a first existent that created everything else. He's saying much, much more than that. Yes, God created everything, but more than that. He takes this, and it's framed in a very interesting way. He's taking it from our perspective. We look at ourselves and we have a sense of our being, right? In fact, if we really have a sense of our being, we should be astounded, because here we are. We are absolutely here. It's amazing that we're here. You could say we're infinitely here, every one of us. We've done nothing to bring ourselves here, but here we are. We find ourselves here. And it's real. We're not an illusion. We are real, and that's amazing. But our reality depends entirely on God. So it's not, yes, he created us, that's for sure. But he also sustains us at every moment. And to any extent that we are right now, each one of us, even in this virtual relationship here, but each one of us is real to the extent that each one of us is real, and we really are real. Our reality doesn't come from us. We don't know how we're here. We have no idea how we got here. Okay, we just find ourselves here. It's a gift. And our reality is dependent on God's absolute reality. At every second, at every instant, it's not, yes, he created us, but far more. He's keeping us in existence, not even just in life, in existence at every moment. So our existence depends on his existence. We would not exist except for the reality of his existence. The term that's used here for reality, an interesting term, it's amita. Not just emet, it's not just the truth of his existence, which it sounds like what truth is a proposition, it's a verbal thing. No, amita is not just truth, it's reality. And that's why he uses the term matsui, Judy, for God, not just havaya. He's trying to get across the reality of God. And it's something that, you know, that each of us, insofar as we can feel that we ourselves are real, which is amazing, we are in touch with that which really makes us real, because we're not doing this. We just find this way. It's totally effortless. But we are here. Whatever makes us real is God. That's an amazing statement. So this first halakha of the Rambam, it's a halakha, is an extraordinary mind opener if we really get it. Okay. Pardon me? Is there somebody trying to say something, or somebody else on? It's hard to hear. So just to get the mind-opening quality of this first statement. Okay? Then he says, if it would be supposed that he, God, does not exist, no other thing could exist. Right? Everything, not only do we not know how we got here, but nothing in this universe knows how it got here. Not any being, not anything, certainly. All of this we haven't done. And we say, not only does God create everything, but God sustains everything at every moment with his existence. So God's existence is not apart from us. It's what sustains us at every instant. He's very careful in how he says this. We're not talking about pantheism here. It's not even a system like Kabbalah. It's a very carefully worded statement here that our existence through and through depends on God's existence in every way at every instant. That is very intimate and very astounding. Okay. And if it would be supposed that no other existence except him alone exists, he alone would exist, and he would not be nullified by their nullification. God does not need for God's existence anything else in the universes. For all existence need him, but he, blessed be, does not need them, nor any one of them. And therefore, his reality is not like the reality of any one of them. So that's another important and different statement. We can't judge and have a sense of the reality of God based on any of our experience with the creatures or beings of the world, or the world itself in its totality. Whatever God's reality is, we have no idea. And yet we know that God is, we have to know that, not just believe it, but whatever that reality is of God, we have no idea, no hasaga. Okay. It's extraordinary, but it's true. And this is as the prophet says, okay, Yirmiyahu, Hashem Elokim Emet. Hashem is true God. Okay. He alone is real. No other is real like his reality. And true here is, you know, Yirmiyahu uses in true as opposed to false gods, but the Rambam is moving from Elkim Emet to Amitat Hashem, to the reality of God. More than just a true statement, a real fact. And this is what the Torah says, Ein Od Milvado. And this is an amazing interpretation of this verse. Ein Od Milvado. There's nothing else but him. The Rambam takes this hyper literally. There is nothing else real but God. There is no real existence but God. And so, insofar as it's not that we're an illusion. We're real, but our reality comes from God, not from ourselves. If you get that, you might actually have an extraordinary herata da'at, an enlightenment of mind. It's an extraordinary statement. And notice, by the way, this is the Mishneh Torah. It's a work of halakha. The Rambam has gone to halakha number 4 before he brings in a pasuk, a verse. All these statements up above were philosophic statements, and it's only in halakha number 4, that he actually brings the first verse in this great text of Jewish law. But this is his way. He is giving us a context for the texts of Torah. Okay? And in this case, the context is a Jewish philosophical vision in which a statement like Ein Od Milvado, there is nothing else but God, now has a new meaning. Okay, you might have thought that it meant Ein Od Milvado, there's no other, deity but God. No, that's not what that means. The Rambam takes this, what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying there is Ein Od Milvado, there is nothing else real but God. An extraordinary statement, yeah? Powerful. So now, in Halacha 5, and these are called Halacha. This existent is God of the world. He's not just out there as, detached from everything, heaven forbid. He's God of the world. Completely, the world is completely dependent on God, and God is completely caring for this world. Lord of the whole earth, he guides the sphere with a power that has no end and no limit, with a power that does not cease, for the sphere revolves continuously, and it is impossible that it revolve without one who caused it to revolve, and he, blessed be, he is the one who caused it to revolve without hand and without body. All right, God is God of the world. This whole world is, in God's hashkacha, God's providential care. He now brings a kind of an argument for a sense of God's presence and God's care from something called the sphere. And here we get into an issue that might make us a little uncomfortable in the 21st century, but we actually is a very important model for us in the 21st century. This notion of the sphere and certain other notions that come up here in philosophy comes from Aristotle. The Rambam was not ashamed of this. He was quite upfront about this. The Rambam had high respect for Aristotle in the 12th century. Aristotle was the thing. I mean, Aristotle's philosophy was the philosophy. It was rediscovered in the 11th and 12th centuries. It was very popular at his time. And so he uses Aristotle, philosophy, and Aristotle's science as proofs for Torah. His understanding is that before our exile, this is before the Babylonian exile, the Jewish people were very sophisticated, in touch with state-of-the-art science and philosophy and all thought of the time. During the exile, we lost this. We were distracted by terrible suffering of the exile throughout the Babylonian Empire. So we regressed in terms of wisdom. We regressed in terms of sophistication and intellectual maturity. And we come back to Eretz Yisrael in Second Temple period. Now we're, in his time, we were again exiled. But we have echoes of our own traditions we can find among the Greeks and the Babylonians and others, and they remind us of the wisdom that we had. So for him, Aristotle is not foreign wisdom. Aristotle is regaining traditions that we already knew. Okay. So Aristotle had this notion that all of the world that we have the earth here, we're on the earth, and around us are spheres, and the furthest sphere of the sphere of the stars, and it rotates around the earth. Of course, now we know that the earth is what rotates. And that sphere is going all the time. It's always moving, you know, day and night, sunrise, sunset. And that rotation means something's moving. The whole world is moving. And there needs to be a power that moves that. There must be a power that moves that. And Aristotle was a monotheist. He was Greek, but he didn't believe in the Greek pantheon. He was a monotheist. And he understood that that power that moves everything, the sphere and everything within it, is God. So the Rambam is bringing what he thinks here is a proof for God's presence, that, you know, we look around us and this world is on, it's moving. He thought it, in terms of a sphere that moves, and something has to be moving it. That something is God. Okay. Now, today, of course, we don't look at it in Aristotelian terms, but today still, we look at this world and it is on. The world is essentially packaged energy. It's an energy field, as the physicists want to say today. The so-called quantum field. And it is on. It's happening. This is an energetic reality that we're in. And to that extent, something, you know, has to be that providing that energy, making that, turning this world on. It has turned this world on and keeps it on. Even contemporary physics and the notion of the quantum field and that all of reality, we think it's matter. It's not matter. It's packaged energy held together by forces. And that this energy isn't sets of fields. And this, you know, contemporary quantum physics is a proof for the existence of God, for the presence and existence of God as the God of this world. I think the Rambam today would be very happy with the advances of quantum physics to giving him even a more persuasive understanding of the presence of God as, you know, Lord of the whole earth and of all reality. And now, in the sixth halakha, he finally says, to know this is a positive commandment, a mitzvat aseh, as it says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. You know, the first of the Ten Commandments. I am Hashem, your God. That's the mitzvah. And all of this that he set up to this point is informing us on how to know this, how to fulfill this mitzvah, to know that Hashem says, I am Hashem, your God. Okay? Anyone who supposes that there's another God besides this one transgresses a prohibitive commandment, as it says, you shall have no other gods before me, the next mitzvah. And Ten Commandments, and denies the essential principle, for this is the essential principle that everything depends on. Okay, so all of this up to this point has been to help us understand the first mitzvah of the Torah, in terms of chashivut, in terms of importance and significance, to know that there is God, and to know it with philosophical sophistication, in a deeply thoughtful way. And that means now it moves on to the next mitzvah of the philosophical mitzvot. This God is one. He is neither two nor more than two, for there's nothing like his oneness among any one of the individuals that exist in the world. Not one like the unit of a genius. Sorry?
Yeah. This is Laura.
Hi.
Hi. Ain old milavado. I want to talk about that a little. So it's kind of like, though, we are extensions of God and we are real for some time. It's kind of like what's the real me? And well, my heart and my brain are the real me. I can live without my legs. I can live without my hands. But does that mean my legs and my hands are not real? Yes, they are real. They're extensions of my heart and my head. And we are extensions of Hashem.
In some way.
We can't live without him. Yeah, that's the main thing. But aren't we real?
That's what they're saying. We are real. In other words, we look at ourselves and we sense that we are real. We don't know how we got to be here and where our reality comes from, but we're real. We didn't make ourselves, but we find ourselves real. And what the Rambam is saying is our reality is based on God's reality. Not just that God created us at one point and now is left, but our reality at every instant is based on God's reality. And now we're real, but we're real because God is real, not because we're real. You know,
I think we just need to understand what this means, real.
Yes, exactly. We're using word. Let's save these discussions.
What is real?
We'll save it for a little bit later because this is your question for is an excellent question, but it's a big question. The Rambam is talking from our experience. He's based on the understanding that we are real. This is amazing. We're really real. We're infinitely, not eternally, but infinitely here, absolutely here. Whoa, what does that? We didn't. It's effortless. We just find ourselves here. We're real, but our reality doesn't come from us. We didn't make it. It's from God, God's reality. And not God at some point in the past, but right now, God's reality is what makes us real. It's an amazing statement, but you have to think deeply, deeply about it. Okay. So now, moving on here. We say God is one. What do when we say the Shema twice a day at least, do we know what we're really saying? Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. What does Echad mean? So the Rambam here, every one of these statements is mind-blowing, okay? There is nothing like his oneness among any of the individuals that exist in the world. Not one like the unit of a genus, which embraces many units, you know, one thing, many things. Not one like the unit of a body, which is divisible into parts and particles. I have my one body, but I also have hands and arms. And, you know, rather, a unity that there is no unity like it in the world. And this he is he's based on a previous statement by Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Bakuda in Chovot HaLevavot. You may know this text, Duties of the Heart. Rabbeinu Bachya insists very strongly, emphasizes, the oneness of God is an absolute oneness. It is not one like the number one. You know, the number one is a relative one. There's one, two, three. It's not that kind of one. It's not one like a thing is one. It's an absolute oneness, a absolute singularity. And we have really no concept like this. The Rabbeinu Bachya says, you can't really grasp the nature of God's oneness, which is amazing. We say this statement twice a day, you know, every day of our lives. We don't even know what we mean. Rabbeinu Bachya says, this notion of oneness is beyond the human mind to grasp. The way Sefer Yetzirah says it, Lifnei Achad Ma'ata Sofer. Before the number one, what can you count? God's oneness is like that. It's a one before one, a one beyond one. Because it's not like we look at we get our sense of numbers from things in the world, and God is not like a thing in the world. God's oneness is absolute. There's no unity like it in the world, says the Rambam. Which gives us a big challenge to say the Shema properly, to fulfill this mitzvah. Ultimately, to say the Shema properly is to experience God's oneness. It's beyond a concept. It's not an idea. It's not a number. It's not a number one. You have to experience it by fully immersing in God's oneness. And Rabbeinu Bachya talks about this in Chovot Levavot. And the Rambam talks about this in The Guide of the Perplexed. But right here, he just keeps it simple. Simple and hard. A unity, there's no other unity like it in the world. If there were many deities, they would be bodies and corporeal, because a number of things, of beings that are equal in existence are not separate from each other, except by way of accidents that occur to bodies. So any religion that believes in multiple deities, those deities are separate by having some aspect of physicality to them. So of course, that's an illusion. It's a false notion. Any sense of God in a true sense cannot be physical and has to be one. If the creator were corporeal, material, and have an end and a limit, for it's impossible there'd be a body which does not have an end. And anything whose body has an end and limit, its power has an end and limit. But God, blessed be his name, since his power has no limit and does not cease, behold, the sphere revolves continually, we'll grant him that. His power is not a physical power. Since he is not a body, it doesn't occur to him any of the accents of bodies. Therefore, he cannot be other than one. The knowledge of this is a positive commandment, as it says, Hashem, our God, Hashem is one. Now note, he says also something important here. Hashem is one, and with a oneness that we can't even properly conceive. And Hashem is endless or infinite, without limit. This is important to remember. The Kabbalists also stress this point that the Rambam makes. It's not just that God is one. God is also infinite. And we have to remember that. Religions that believe in monotheism, oneness of God, but don't remember that God is also infinite, get these very narrow notions of God. There's a religion predominant in the Middle East that's like that, okay? They know that God is one, but they forget that God is infinite. If you remember that God is infinite, you know that you have to open your mind to have a sense of God, and that you can have many approaches, you know, to God that can be true. And there's it opens up our whole sense of relating to Hashem. Rather than being something very narrow and rigid, it becomes very open, very expansive, and needs all of the help of all of us to approach properly. So that's an important point that the Rambam is making that the Kabbalists pick up on. It's also that it says in the Torah that God is incorporeal. God is not, does not have a body. And he brings the proofs for that. Who shall make you liken me, that I should be equal to them, etc. If he was corporeal, he would be like other bodies. So that raises the question that we have throughout Tanakh, that we have all these expressions about God that seem to indicate physicality by God. There was under his feet a sapphire work. The Luchot, the tablets of the Ten Commandments were written with the finger of God, the hand of God, the eyes of God, the ears of the Lord. All of these statements throughout Tanakh, also the other Nevi'im, also. If the Torah understands and is insisting for us that God is not physical in any way, where do all these statements come from? So he says, all is in accordance with the conception of those human beings who cannot recognize anything but bodies. And the Torah speaks according to the language of human beings. They are all metaphors. So this is an important principle. The Rambam here is based on Rav Sadia Gaon. He's the first to make this very, very clear. These statements, which we call anthropomorphisms, statements in which God is described in ways that seem like human forms, are poetic. They're metaphors. They're meant to be understood figuratively, not literally. And this is an important key to understanding the Torah, says the Rambam, here and also in his Guide of the Perplexed. The Torah is speaking in human language, which uses metaphor, and also for those Jews who have very limited conception and can only think of great things in physical terms, to get across that there's God. But God, God's self, is not corporeal, and these statements should be understood metaphorically, God's hand, but God's eye, God's ear. But the Rambam goes further than this, as Rav Sadia Gaon does, and he says that not only are these poetic statements or metaphors, but they're more than that, they're code. Every one of these statements is actually a philosophic code. So for instance, which means not just a metaphor, but a technical term that's getting across a philosophic principle. So for instance, as the Rambam will explain, when the Torah talks about the hand of God, it's referring to God's hashkacha. Hand becomes a metaphor for God's providential care, God, the whole world in his hands, that God is taking care of the whole world, the hand of God. When the Torah speaks of the eyes of God, and Hashem, Allah Aretz, it's referring to God's omniscience, that God knows everything that's happening, not by visual sight, but God knows everything. So these metaphors are not just poetry, they're code. Okay? And he gives examples like that. Okay? So now, moving on, I'm sorry to move this a little quickly, but I do want to give some time for questions also. Chapter 2, it's extraordinary. He ramps this up, and the Rambam says, this God who is glorified and awesome, the next mitzvah, it's a positive mitzvah, to love God and to fear God. As it says, you shall love Hashem your God, you have to Hashem Elokecha, and Hashem your God you shall fear. What is the way to love and fear him? So we think of loving God as an emotional relationship with God. Okay? We love God through tefillah, we love God through dancing and song, we love God through, you know, in some emotional way. What, look at the Rambam's approach here. How do you love God? When a person contemplates his works and his wondrous and great creatures, and beholds through them his wisdom that is inestimable and without limit, he will immediately love, praise, and glorify, and long with a great longing to know the great name, God. As David said, my soul thirsts for God, for the living God. So how do we love God, according to the Rambam? Through science and philosophy. Contemplating God's works, God's creatures, understanding God's wisdom, looking around the world, understanding that the more we understand this world scientifically, philosophically, the more we will really love God with a true love, not with just an imagined love. The more we understand reality in truth, the more we understand God, and the more we love God. That's a real Rambam approach. And he'll go on, he'll say that I'll elucidate great principles among the works of the master of the world. So I'm going to show you scientifically this wondrous world so you really appreciate God and come to love God. Once you understand the world more deeply, immediately this will prompt in you a sense of love. It comes from deep scientific, philosophic contemplation. The Rambam was not afraid of science. He embraced the science of his time, which was a flawed science. He would love the science of our time, which is still a flawed science, you know, but you know, bring it on, you know, let's understand this world, not hide from it, not paste fantasies over it or illusions, but understand this world as it is. But then, so he says, and when he will think of all these matters themselves, he will be taken aback and fear, and realize that he is a small creature, low, benighted, meaning low of wisdom, ignorant, standing with knowledge superficial and obscure before the perfect mind. God, among other things, is the perfect mind. As David says, when I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, what is man that you are mindful of him? So to love God is to contemplate God's world. To fear God, what's that then? That's to put ourselves in the picture. We're in this extraordinary world filled with wonders and wisdom, and who are we? And if we get the humility of that, we wouldn't dare to assert some of the things that we as human beings sometimes assert, even people that are in leadership positions as human beings assert. We should have great, great humility and fear to put ourselves in, to realize that we are in this extraordinary world of gods. In accordance with these matters, I'll elucidate great principles from among the works of the master of the world so they might serve as an opening for an understanding person, by which to love the name. As the sages say on the subject of love, from this you will recognize who spoke, he who spoke, and the world came to be. So for Rambam, the more that you know, the more that you will love. And this is a mature approach to love. This is true in, even in our mature loving relationships. The more we know the other person, the more, and really know them, we really love them. At the beginning of a relationship, you might have all kinds of fantasies about the other person. Then over time, you get to know them. That mature love, that mature knowledge is a mature love. And that's what the Rambam is saying here. Let me put in one more piece here just to blow your minds, and then we'll have our conversation. Is that okay? So here the Rambam says, this is now continuing. He says, I'm going to give you some philosophic understanding so you come to love God more. All existence, aside from the Creator, from the first form down to the small mosquito in the depths of the earth, came into being from his reality. Okay. Since he knows himself and recognizes his greatness, radiance, and truth, he knows everything and nothing is hidden from him. God knows all of reality, the universes, all the worlds. God knows all reality by knowing God's self. So he explains. The Holy One, blessed be, he recognizes his reality and knows it as it is. He does not know with a knowledge which is external to him in the way we know. For ourselves and our knowledge are not one. You know, we are composite human beings. We've got minds and consciousness, and we have bodies. Our consciousness goes to sleep for, you know, 4 to 8 hours a night. We know, sometimes even when we're awake, we are not in a knowing state. So every once in a while we know things. And sometimes we don't know things, and sometimes we just feel things, etc. So knowledge, we're not just knowledge. We're composite, and knowledge flickers every once in a while. So our knowledge is not all of us, it's an aspect of us. But the Creator, may be blessed, he, his knowledge and his life are one from all sides and corners in all manners of unity. We have three different words here, but they're not, God is all one. So God, there's God, God knows, God is alive, if we want to say it that way in some metaphorical sense. Even knowledge is a metaphor. However God does all this, it's all in absolute unity. God is not different from his knowledge. For if we were to live through a principle of life or know through knowledge that was other than him, there would be multiple deities because that knowledge would also be divine. But the matter is not so, rather flow with this for a moment, you'll see where he's going. Rather, one from every side and corner, every manner of unity. And here's, catch this. It turns out that one should say that he, God, is the knower, the known, and the knowing itself, all one. An amazing formula. God is the knower, the known, what he knows, and the knowing itself, all one. This matter is not in the power of the mouth to express or the ear to hear, nor the heart of a person to recognize clearly. An amazing statement, yeah? So all of this reality, you know, God is the perfect mind, and not just that God knows this reality, God created this, created all of us and everything, and God knows it by knowing God's self. As he says later on, he does not recognize and know the creations in terms of the creations as we know them, but rather he knows them because of himself. That's, since he knows himself, he knows everything. For everything depends on him and his existence. That comes back to that statement we started with. God knows everything by knowing God's self. God created everything, and his everything is known by knowing himself. An amazing statement. And he is the knower, the known, and the knowing. Now, the Rambam did not originate this statement. He got it from Aristotle. When in doubt, say Aristotle. The Aristotle, in his book called The Metaphysics, chapter 12, says God is the thinker, the object of thought, and the process of thinking. Aristotle was a monotheist also. And the Rambam liked that formula. He put it into Torah terms. God is the knower, the known, and the knowing. And in this, he's getting across a profound, I mean, an idea that we can't even grasp, but that God's awareness of this world, you know, is totally intimate. We can't even imagine how intimate it is. God is knowing us, and he knows each one of us, by knowing himself. The Rambam is not ashamed to say he got it from Aristotle. He's very upfront about that in Guide of the Perplexed. He's not ashamed to say that, you know, that there are others in the world, you know, outside the Torah world that can come, you know, sort of mekaveh, that can focus their minds in a way that expresses Torah itself. He's not ashamed about that, but he takes it to a deeper level. He applies this in ways that Aristotle couldn't have imagined. Okay, to understand that this confirms the oneness of God in this most profound way. So we'll put this all together. I want to give some time now for, if you have any questions. Yeah, Judy, we'll give a little time to question this because it's a mouthful right here. But hopefully you get across the vision of the Rambam here, that it's profoundly thoughtful. You could even call it mystical in its way. And I think the Rambam is not just a rationalist, but is a mystic as well, and we'll prove that later on. And it's an understanding of reality that enriches our own understanding of the world and ourselves. Okay, hopefully that comes across. We'll pursue that further. So if you have questions, I'm going to stop screen share. And if you have questions, I guess the best thing, people raise hands and then unmute. Is that how we do this? Everyone know how to do that? Leah, yeah.
I just read recently Richardson Rebbe, who lived in the 19th century, and his disciple asked, it said that Aristotle knew about universe more than Rambam. How do you explain it? And Richardson Rebbe said, there are two men. They came to the palace of the king. So one man looked at all the beautiful and the special stuff around it, goes room to room, and another one said, I want to go to the king.
Right. I mean, again,
what
I think
he said, so I want to go to the king.
Yeah, exactly. Let me just be clear about this in terms of Rambam and Aristotle. The Rambam does not just follow Aristotle, not at all. He's very critical of Aristotle. Again, Aristotle, you know, was what century is that? Third before the Common Era, whatever. The Rambam is the 12th century. He's far more sophisticated. So the Rambam has a very critical approach to Aristotle. He criticizes him when he needs criticism, but also when there's truth. The Rambam has a principle. We accept truth wherever we find truth. And we're not defensive about that. And we're not, don't have to be afraid of the world and afraid of, you know, of other knowledge. We have Torah. Torah is robust. Torah is powerful. And if there's truth, we can accept it. And Torah gives us the ability to be critically aware and reject things that are not true as well. You know, so the Rambam had that. You're right about that. I don't think it's true to say that Aristotle knew science more or philosophy more than the Rambam. He didn't. Rambam knew much more than Aristotle. But the Rambam knew it in a way that he was taking it to the king, as you say, very nicely. Exactly right. Thank you.
Yes. Rezitan Rebbe said that.
Very good, actually.
18th century.
Yeah.
Hi. Thank you very much. Wonderful topic. Is the Rav aware of where the Rambam might discuss the Shekhinah and its relationship to this whole concept of Hashem Echad and so forth? That would be my question. My question is, how do we understand the Shekhinah in light of Hashem's
Well, the Rambam does not use Kabbalistic terminology. It wasn't known to him yet. His son, Rav Abraham, was aware of Kabbalah that was becoming more popular in the early 13th century, but the Rambam didn't know it yet, so he wouldn't have used that terminology. He does talk to some extent in part one, in chapters, you know, in the area of about chapters 60 and 70, about something like the Shekhinah in Guide of the Perplexed. So you can, you know, possibly look there, but I don't think you'll find the terms that you're looking for directly in the Rambam. However, the Kabbalists, the Mekubalim, read the Guide of the Perplexed very carefully, and they knew that the Rambam had the essence of Kabbalah. he wasn't a Kabbalist, but the essential principles of Kabbalah are all there. They really are all there. I could show you at another time, you know, and maybe we'll refer to it at the end when we do some of the Guide to the Perplexed, you know, where some of the Kabbalists show that the Rambam really understood the essence of Kabbalah.
Thank you.
Sure. Someone else? Anyone else? I'm glad this is all clear.
Rabbi, also like Avigdor Miller, he looks in the word that you said, this is a proof of Hashem. He talk about everything we see, starting from the fruit, how it become not, so we know when fruit is ready, when become yellow, for example. He talk about every part of the body as a proof, as a knowledge. It's amazing, you know, amazing
Shurim,
but
Avigdor Miller. Yeah, the more we understand this world around us, the deeper we will love God. There's no question about it. And we should not be afraid of knowledge, of any knowledge. It's true that, it's the case that some scientists overstate what they think the power of science is, and we can reject that. And some scientists lose track of God. I mean, so we reject that. But that doesn't mean to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there are, when you have really essential science and scientists who have intellectual humility, you can learn deeply about God by looking at every knowledge in the world. The Vilna Gaon, right, who is like, you know, the whole Lithuanian yeshiva tradition of today comes out of the Vilna Gaon and Rav Chaim of Volozhin. The Vilna Gaon said, to the extent that a person is ignorant of science, they are ignorant of Torah. Okay, really important to remember that.
No, so Rabbi, a physics professor at MIT, he wrote a book, A Science of God. It's like how he saw God like as a science, as a proof of it. And I have this book, it's an interesting book, The Science of God.
Okay, good. All right, any other questions?
The objection. You
want to
go, Avigal? You
want to
go?
Unmute. If you need, someone is asking. Is that Lana talking? Unmute. I can't. We can't quite hear you though. How do we unmute you? You're still.
I unmuted you.
To turn on your.
Yeah, we still don't
have. Muted. Unmute you.
You have to unmute yourself now. I clicked it. You could unmute yourself.
Unmute yourself,
Abigail.
Maybe turn up your microphone itself. Is your voice on? Oi. Can you maybe send
sign
us
language?
Oh, I'm so sorry. So we're not hearing it. How do we do this?
You're unmuted officially. But
I think what she sent a chat, and I think chat. She wants you.
Oh, the chat! The chat.
People to read the chat. She wrote it on chat.
Okay,
I'm getting Abigail.
I got it. Okay, I learned from Rabbi Ginsburg. What Abigail said. I learned from Rabbi Ginsburg that when Hashem separated the upper and lower waters during creation, that the upper waters are Torah, and the lower waters is science. Okay. Nice. Thank you. So I mean that's a drasha, okay, but a nice drasha, and it gets the point. Yes, Torah is the upper wisdom, science is a lower wisdom, no question about it. And that compares also with what Leah was saying, you know, Torah is taking us to the king, not just facts. Yes, Torah is our upper wisdom, and the Rambam says also that Torah is the upper wisdom, science is a lower wisdom. And if science becomes useful in some ways to loving God and understanding God and reality more, that's fine. But Torah is the upper wisdom. Thank you, Abigail. That's excellent. Excellent. Puts it all in perspective. Yeah. Aura and then Sue.
May I, first of all, thank you. That was just really, really wonderful class. My question is not from my experience, but from people that I've met over the last number of years who are serious learners in some serious yeshivot in Yerushalayim, let's say, for example, is they're constantly in a classroom
learning, 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 learning. And according to the Rambam, it's like, go live life, be in the land, see the land, see the beauty of what God created, to really ingest the truth of Torah. Why, it seems like there's a contradiction in some of these yeshivas who sit in a classroom 20 hours a day and are not experiencing the gifts that God gave us.
Yeah, it's. We'll talk more about that. I think we'll get there next time, Be'ezrat Hashem. We're going to talk about how the Rambam looks at the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And he does have some critiques to make. I mean, he is not, for instance, a fan of the concept of a kolel. He believes that everybody should work, and that work will enhance your understanding of Torah. I mean, if we're learning the halachot of business, which is, you know, the guts, the nuts and bolts of halacha, is the halacha, the halachot of business and financial dealings, and that, you know, that's a choshen mishpat, and you don't know anything about business, you don't know what you're talking about. Unless you understand people and the world and how the world works, you don't know, and it becomes a fantasy or an illusion.
Right.
He'll say that. We'll see that on the inside. However, this is not to take away from, the Rambam also learned Torah 20 hours a day. He was open to the world. He was also a physician, a doctor. He was open to the world. He worked hard. But he also understands the importance of learning Torah in a deep way. So the issue is not to stop learning, you know, in yeshiva. The issue is to enrich the yeshiva curriculum that will include, you know, first of all, get out there and work. That's really important. And it's not just because it's practical to earn a living. It's because it will also, I mean, it's not only practical for your life, it is, but it's also enhances your Torah. Your Torah learning is better when you work for a living. We'll see why. He'll talk about that next time. But also, he was learning all the time, but we have to understand what it means to learn all the time. And that can be done in a very, very diverse way. I'll put it that way. And I think what you're getting at is we need some diversity in the real yeshiva curriculum. There are yeshivot that do that. I won't mention names now, but there are wonderful yeshivot that have a more sort of well-integrated curriculum. And I think that's a healthy way. I mean, that would be the Rambam's way, as we'll see. Good point. Another.
Nia wants to point out again, she wrote something again on the chat.
Yes, which says, there's a place for those who study Torah. Torah study sustains the world. Most people work and few people can learn all the time. Well, it's an important point. We'll get to that also next time, God willing. But let me just say that the notion of learning full-time, is meant for elite students, not just for everybody. Because a lot of people that sit and learn all the time, they really should be out working as well. I mean, they're just not at that level. There are people, as you say, there's a place for those who study Torah all the time. And in the old yeshivot of the Gaonim of Bavel, you had to take a test every month to see if you were keeping up and you had the level to be in the yeshiva. If you didn't pass that test, you could come to learn at the yeshiva, but you would not get a stipend to learn, and you'd be sent home to work when it was time to work. You know, so that was a better way. It's a healthier way. There's reasons why I don't want to get into a critical thing.
You don't get a good shidduch.
What's that?
You don't get a good shidduch.
Yeah. I mean, that, don't we get into that whole world? The point is, and the Rambam also, is that there are elite scholars that should be learning, but even those elite scholars should work for a living. You know, I'll give you an example. In Boston, we had a kolel. It was based on the Ner Yisrael Kolel, very great rabbis, but all of them taught. They didn't just learn all day. Every one of them was responsible to go out and teach as well. So they did work as well as learn. And it was a much healthier approach. They got out to be among people. They went to different shuls and taught, you know. So it's a much healthier vision than just sitting and learning and losing touch with reality, which unfortunately has happened. You know, we'll talk more about that because it is the Rambam's theme next time. Yeah, Sue.
Just a quick follow-up. You had said that the Rambam actually didn't have a Kabbalah so much as his background for what he was saying. So I'm wondering, he talks about these deep esoteric concepts about knowing Hashem and how Hashem knows himself and Hashem Achad. They're mind-blowing. So I can't even picture having all that without some kind of sod, without some kind of Kabbalistic overlay. What does he base it on?
It's in Torah tradition itself, though not technically Kabbalah. I mean, everything that he says is in Torah. Right? But it's not in the Kabbalistic system of Sfirot. But it's in Torah. It's in the Gemara, but it's also in philosophy and science and all of that. And he brings it together. And yes, he is a mystic. I really argue that strongly. He is a mystic. But we have to understand, and the Kabbalists love him. Don't let anyone say otherwise. They love him. They understand he didn't have Kabbalah, but they know that he's on the track. He's on the derech of that. So they quote him. They refer to him. They love him. Yeah. All right. I think that this will be good for a good start for this session. We'll pick this up next time. The Rambam has more exciting and extraordinary things to say here. A whole bunch, and all on the way towards understanding how he's going to apply all this in halakha. In everyday halakha, in the most profound levels, in the most everyday levels. We'll see this as we go forward.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Thank you so very much.
Great to be with you all. It's exciting to be back together with the Bas Midrash. And I thank you, Judy. And again, all of our learning for Refuah Shleima to Rabbi Sachs, to all of the people that were mentioned, Deb, and all the people who were mentioned.
What is Rabbi Sachs' names?
It's Yaakov Tzvi Ben Liba.
Yaakov
Tzvi Ben Liba.
Okay.
Yeah, for Shalema.
Okay, I just want to mention that this recording of the shiur will be available on our website, basmedrash.org, okay, as well as the source material. So I want everybody to get used to using it as a resource. That's what it's for. And again, thank you to Rivka Weinstein for preparing it.
Thank you. Well done. Yeah.
And thank you so much, Rabbi Sender. We're really so happy to have you back. And we're really enjoying this year very much. So we look forward to more.
Thanks. Thanks to you. Thanks to you, everyone. Chodesh Tov to everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah,